With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Welcome to SI's Planet Football Podcast, where each week we discuss the latest in the world of soccer. I am SI.com's soccer editor, Avi Krediter, joined today by SI senior writer Grant Wall and SI.com's Brian Strauss. And guys, today's podcast is presented by three letters, USA. It's been pretty remarkable. America, there it is. Been a pretty remarkable week, couple of weeks. If you want to throw Loretta Lynch and the DOJ into this, it's been an amazing month, really, for the United States and the world of soccer. We're going to focus, though, on the U.S. men's national team, U.S. women's national team. We're going to start with the men who swept the Netherlands and Germany, two of the top three finishers in the 2014 World Cup. Naturally, these were not full-strength teams, though neither was the USA. Grant, let's start with you. Two wins over the Netherlands and Germany. Is this the revolution that we were promised? Is everything happening? Is it taking off?
My running take here is this was a very promising week for Jurgen Klinsmann and the U.S. men's national team, and I just want to leave it at that. You know, I mean, this was very, very impressive, and we've seen this a couple of times before with the U.S. winning friendlies at Italy early in Klinsmann's tenure at Mexico, and as far as friendlies, they're friendlies, right? But still, I mean, this was two games that the U.S. deserved to win, in my opinion, and to win in Amsterdam, to win in Cologne. As someone said on Twitter, I forgot who, also the U.S. also beat Blatter in Switzerland. Not bad at all, and very encouraged, I think, from a confidence perspective for a lot of young guys like Bobby Wood, like Giassi Zardes. You go on down the list. There were guys who played well, and I talked to Giassi Zardes the other day before the Germany game. He scored his first international goal in the Amsterdam Arena in a 4-3 win against Holland, and he said the big takeaway he had was he felt like he belonged on the field with Robin Van Persie and Danny Blind and, you know, Memphis Depay, all these Man United guys. And that if Giassi Zardes is taking that away from this trip, then already – it's more than just winning on the field. It's a victory in a bigger sense.
Yeah, and that's important for sure. And that's, you know, this trip could have gone one of two ways, right? They could have bombed. They could have been blown off the field. It looked like they were going to be against the Netherlands. But Brian, they really made Klinsmann's scheduling pay off because, like Grant says, it's a confidence boost. They've got one game against Guatemala left, and then it's the Gold Cup, and there's no better way to enter a tournament like that than with these couple of wins, and especially the way they played late against Germany that second half, taking that and rolling it forward into CONCACAF.
Yeah, no, they'll certainly be confident. And look, Jurgen practices what he preaches. Give him credit for that. He talks about a higher level. He talks about pushing yourself. He talks about comfort zones and the exit from comfort zones, and that's what he's done with this team in terms of taking them to places where they do risk heavy defeat, they do risk embarrassment, you know. And obviously Denmark and Switzerland are not Netherlands and Germany, but he took them there as well. He's taken them to Genoa, he's taken them to Azteca. He's using these friendly dates to really test the boundaries of this team and how far he can push them and how far he can challenge them. And credit to him for that. These guys are, you know, Zardes thinks he belongs on the field in part because they're now used to playing under these conditions and these kinds of settings. You've got young guys here who nothing phases. And I think it's important to note, I remember sitting in the press conference right after the World Cup final in Rio de Janeiro, and one of the first things Yogi Love did was thank Jurgen Klinsmann and credit Jurgen Klinsmann for establishing a foundation for Germany. And one of the big parts of that was young, fearless, energetic players, you know, players who were dynamic, players who had range, players who would go forward, and players who weren't awed by an occasion. And games like these help you know, bring that out in people. You know, if you can do it, you know, if you can do it on a Wednesday night in Amsterdam, you know, you can do it in the Gold Cup. You can do it in a lot of the settings that the U.S. typically finds themselves in. So credit to Jurgen for creating a crucible that's, you know, bringing those kinds of things out in players like Giassi Zardes and Jordan Morris.
Absolutely. Jordan Morris and Zardes and Bobby Wood, Brian, I know there's a term that you like to call what happens when these young players get thrown onto the field and good things happen. I won't spoil it. I'll let you put it out there. But that's really one of the big takeaways here is that these guys stepped up in place of Jozy Altidore and Clint Dempsey and Jermaine Jones and they got it done. But what is the magic word that you like to throw out here?
The term that's been bouncing around, I didn't make it up, but the term bouncing around since last year is Jurgen Dust. And Jurgen Dust is just the magical, you know, it's this guy's toast always lands jam side up, right? That's Jurgen Dust. When he leaves Landon Donovan at home, he brings Julian Green to the World Cup and Julian Green scores a goal with his first touch. That's Jurgen Dust. And Jurgen Dust is in effect. I mean, who wasn't scratching their head over Bobby Wood? Everybody was. What is this guy doing on the team? What does he bring? He was invisible in appearance after appearance, maybe five or six or so. And then all of a sudden, you know, the goal against the Netherlands was, you know, it was, he didn't do much of the work on that goal. I mean, that was Bradley and Jordan Morris, and he was there to sort of finish it, but that's part of a striker's job. But then the strike against Germany was fabulous. I mean, that was a touch, took him over, you know, he gave himself a good bit of distance from a defender with that first touch, turned, you know, found a sliver along the left post from 25 yards out and buried it. I mean, that was a world-class strike, and it came out of nowhere from a guy who's being relegated to the German third division. So that's Jurgen Dust. It's you know, in the Hall of Fame of Jurgen Dust. But again,
I would actually say that he was visible, Bobby Wood, in U.S. games, but he was actually so visibly bad that I can't imagine a player in recent memory for the U.S. who was more reviled by fans, to the point where when Wood came in against Holland, the reaction on Twitter was universal disgust from U.S. fans. And then he scores the winning goal, and suddenly things start changing, and this guy who was just – couldn't finish anything in a U.S. uniform, wasn't doing anything at club level, scores one of the greatest goals I've seen by a U.S. player. It was just a fantastic play from the start.
Yedlin's another example of Jurgen Dust. I mean, a guy who thought he had no prayer of going to the World Cup a few months earlier, gets put on the field and dazzles in a couple of games. So Jurgen clearly has a knack, clearly has some insight into – you know, he can find a young untested player and say, this guy won't fold under pressure. This guy under the bright lights against a superior or at least a heralded opponent is going to take it to them. And he saw that in Zardes. And he's seen that in Jordan Morris, who, let's remember, is going to be a college junior. And he just has a knack for seeing these qualities in people. Why he's able to do that, but then not get the best out of a player like Landon Donovan. I mean, the Twitter angst I've seen over the past few days is, what does Benny Failhaber have to do to get a chance? Jurgen doesn't want to work with Benny Failhaber. So why Jurgen's able to get the best out of a guy like Bobby Wood or Giassi Zardes but struggles with other sorts of players is a question going forward. But clearly the last two games demonstrated that he has a knack for picking guys who can thrive in these situations.
Yeah, and one of those situations coming up is going to be the Gold Cup. The U.S. put out its 35-player provisional roster. That'll be whittled down to 23 within the next few weeks. Gold Cup, I believe, starts July 6th. I could be wrong with that, but anyway, around those days. And, you know, there were some surprising omissions. Danny Williams, who's starting these games in Europe, not on the team. Jeff Cameron, not on the team. And then you look at some of the players who are on this team. DeMarcus Beasley, who retired internationally in December. Grant, you can shed some insight on that. But he's offered to come out of retirement to play in this tournament again after captaining the U.S. to the win in 2013. Guys like Alan Gordon, who was part of the semifinal round. Alan Gordon, the Bash brother himself, part of... part of the semifinal round of CONCACAF World Cup qualifying, but really not the first name you think of on, you know, U.S. national team level, and that's not to take anything away. not the name that most people think of on the U.S. national team level, but you know what? There he is. Grant, I guess first go into Beasley, because I know you talked to him about this a little bit, and then just your take on who is and who isn't on this 35-man team.
First, I want to talk Alan Gordon, okay?
Okay, all right.
Alan Gordon is my favorite all-time MLS player, the one player I will say I am in the tank for all time and have rose-colored glasses on everything that guy does. I think he's a winner. I think he's the symbol, if you've read my book, of the everyman in MLS, and I think it's awesome that he's going to be at least considered for the Gold Cup team. That said, you look at the guys who aren't involved. Jeff Cameron's an interesting one, I think. Now, Stu Holden was out here in Vancouver yesterday, and I was asking him about it, and he said that it's a Stoke thing. It's not a Jurgen Cameron thing. That Stoke thinks that Cameron has gone hard now basically for three straight years and needs some time off, and that they made this request. So it's kind of a useful thing to know. I was a little surprised Gedeon Zelalem wasn't on the list, because – I thought that Jurgen might want to cap tie him, even if he wasn't going to use him a lot during Gold Cup. Just get him on the field for a game, and then, you know, no worries at all. The guy's with the U.S. forever, even though he appears to be very committed to the U.S. and is having a good U-20 World Cup. Jermaine Jones is injured. Fail Haber just seems like a guy that he and Jurgen don't click, never have. Hasn't worked in a January camp for Fail Haber in the past. I think some guys have used January camp to break out, like Giassi Zardes. We see guys every year, but other guys like Fail Haber, I think, have used the January camp to get written off, which is a little unfortunate, because Fail Haber has been fantastic lately in MLS. We see Beasley and Omar Gonzalez back in the fold. And then DeMarcus Beasley, I did speak to DeMarcus. He said Jurgen approached him. They had a long talk. Klinsmann really wants to win this Gold Cup. This is not about development, and he thinks Beasley is still one of the top left backs out there for the U.S. So a leadership thing as well, because Beasley was the captain of the 2013 team. He's a good guy off the field. And, you know, that's interesting to see. But, you know, DeMarcus Beasley, the only American male to play in four World Cups, coming back to the national team might be kind of a neat story.
It would be. I mean, it came completely out of left field, I thought. I mean, you didn't get the sense that when he retired internationally that it was a part-time thing and that he was going to get the itch to come back. I mean, it seemed like it had some finality to it, and that he was just going to be focused on his club play with the Dynamo. I mean, you don't reach out to the guy and get his, you know, gauge his thoughts on this and put him on the 35-man roster if you're not going to put him on the 23, right? I mean, barring injury, wouldn't you expect him to make that final cut?
I would expect him to make the cut. I think it's a little odd if he were then to – it's kind of like bringing Landon Donovan to a pre-World Cup camp and then cutting him.
Honestly, it kind of –
who would do that?
Nobody, only a monster. No, it's it is. It would be weird, I think, to go to all these lengths and then be like, you know what? Nah, we're good. So I think I would personally think that one of those 23 tickets is punch within. Now, Brian, there are a few veterans that are, you know, good to go for this team, presuming that they're healthy. Josie Altidore, Clint Dempsey, Matt Beasler, and then there are guys who haven't necessarily been consistently with this team. So that's kind of one of the challenges now, right? Is reintegrating them.
Well, I mean, you mentioned two of them. Dempsey and Beasler haven't played with the U.S. since the conclusion of the January camp. There was that early February game against Panama. You know, Dempsey missed these past two friendlies because his wife was about to give birth, and I have no idea if that's happened yet. Do you guys know?
I don't know.
I do not.
There was a fourth kid coming. I had a fascinating conversation with Dempsey's daughter about her pink suitcase at the baggage claim at one of the airports in Brazil, by the way.
Amazing reporting.
Everything was pink. Pink. She was dressed all in pink, and she had a pink suitcase, and she was very proud of it. And, you know, it was a longer conversation than I had with her father than at any point during the World Cup. So, Graham Zusi hasn't played with the U.S. at all this year, you know, and so, like you said, and then no Jeff Cameron, which surprises me. I still feel like he should be one of the four best defenders on this team, but It hasn't really ever clicked for him consistently. I guess it comes to this. You know, it's hard to watch those last two games against the Netherlands and Germany. And by the way, we haven't even mentioned the biggest issue, which is that Michael Bradley was absolutely phenomenal and carried the U.S. to wins on his back in both of those games. Absolutely unstoppable during the last, you know, good 20, 30 minutes of both of those matches. But, you know, you watch those games and you see a lot of qualities that are positive. The fearlessness, the proactive play Klinsmann's been promising for years. But we still don't know what this team looks like when it's at its best. We don't know what this team's best 11 is. We don't know what this team's ideal, you know, formation or tactical deployment is. What does your Gold Cup team look like? What is your Gold Cup 11 in a final against Mexico? We still don't know. And part of establishing things like that is figuring out the partnerships and the chemistry that work on the field. That are ideal for certain players in certain situations. And we have no clue what that looks like. So there's still a lot of work to do, and Jurgen's going to have to really pick the right combination of guys, and he's going to have that one friendly to really sort of set up what this team's going to look like. If he wants to win the Gold Cup, he's going to have to pick a team that can do it, and I don't know that we saw that in the Netherlands and Germany, because there isn't a group that has had that kind of time together to gel and to get used to and comfortable with each other that can carry through, you know, a 3.5-4 week tournament.
That's a good point. And it also, too, it does beg the question after seeing the group that did succeed so well, especially at the end of the game in the Netherlands and then that, you know, the last 45, 50 minutes against Germany. If they can succeed so well in that group, does that now put the pressure on Jozy Altidore and Clint Dempsey to kind of earn their places back, which I think would be a good thing, you could argue.
Jurgen would love that.
Exactly. That's kind of what he strives for. He doesn't guarantee anyone's
spot. There's no one in the Gold Cup that's as talented as the Netherlands or Germany, but they're all going to be trying harder, right? I mean, both of those teams were sort of had one eye on the bus with about 20 to 30 minutes to go, especially the Dutch. I mean, they just stopped playing. I mean, it was really remarkable. But, you know, credit to the U.S. for it still took, you know, commitment and a good bit of skill to win both of those games. But the teams that they play in the Gold Cup are going to be playing 90 minutes. They're going to be playing to win. And they're going to have to find the right combinations and chemistry, you know, to win. You know, it takes six games to win the Gold Cup, and they're going to have to find the right combinations to do that. And we've seen a lot of, for example, we've seen a lot of pairings in central defense. We've seen Michael Bradley play not only with different partners in center midfield, but in different formations in center midfield where his responsibilities shift game to game, situation to situation. So, you know, Jurgen still got plenty of work to do, like I said, to try to find the right combinations for July.
Yeah, so definitely some fascinating weeks ahead for the U.S. men, and definitely some fodder to talk about for sure. I mean, this was kind of an unexpected result from these two games, so we'll see where it goes from here. Now let's shift to the women, who we're taping this the day before they play against Sweden in the second game of the Women's World Cup group stage. They opened with a 3-1 win over Australia. Not the most convincing of first halves, but they came together in the second half. Megan Rapinoe was fantastic. Hope Solo, dealing with some more controversy in the media, was fantastic. And they take 3 points from their first game in the so-called group of death, which I thought was imperative because you don't want to go into a Sweden game. A team that has done well against the U.S. and knows the U.S. well, obviously Pia Sundhage, the former manager. You don't want to need to win that game necessarily. So, Grant, you were up there. You were in Winnipeg. What was your sense around that team after that game? I think they know they can play better and that, you know, they got 3 points, but, right?
Well, and you mentioned Rapinoe and Solo. They're smart soccer players. They know the game. And afterward, they were quick to say, look, we got 3 points here, but we know the ways in which we can play better. We can be more dynamic. We can pass the ball better. We can do a lot of things better. And yet we got those 3 points. And I do think in the second half, their fitness show, not just in a fitness sense, because the Australians sort of wilted, but because the U.S. is able to play a higher level of soccer for a longer period of time. And that's what we saw. You know, the first half, Australia outplayed the U.S. They were connecting better. They were getting better chances. And Solo made two, maybe even three, really remarkable saves that I don't, as you know, Rapinoe said, she didn't know if any other goalkeeper in the world could make those saves. And while that's a little concerning that those chances were allowed, it really did help the U.S. right the ship and go in at 1-1 at halftime and turn things around in the second half. And I think ahead of this Sweden game, we're probably going to see some changes. I don't think Abby Wambach was probably going to start for the Sweden game even before she was largely ineffective for 90 minutes in game one, you know, just because I'm kind of predicting, I guess, that Kristen Press will move up top to start because I think she's more effective in her natural position. Imagine that. And that Tobin Heath might get the start out wide in Press's spot with Wambach going to the bench.
And Pia Sundhage in comments to the New York Times, which I guess were made a few weeks ago, but just the timeliness of it actually makes sense, is she said that Abby Wambach would have been a sub for her anyway if she was still coaching the U.S. At this point. And I know Wambach has been a sub, you know, sporadically for Jill Ellis, and we thought that she, you know, wouldn't be necessarily starting every game anyway. But those two chances that she missed, two anyway, that stick out for me, you would have expected her to finish those. One of them came off the foot of Rapinoe off of a free kick. And just, you know, maybe it's better for her to have more in the tank later in the game when other teams are more battered and kind of not on that same energy level. So maybe that is the best use of her going forward. But I want to go back to Rapinoe a little bit because you wrote about this. Hell, we put four players on the SI cover and none of them were Megan Rapinoe. Is she the most underrated player on this team? She has been a part of so many big moments in the Olympics and World Cups. And it seems like we only really recall that, at least on a more mainstream level, every 2 years.
Well, the thing with Rapinoe also is I think she does things that few or no other U.S. players do in a creative sense on the field. But there are also moments, and let's be honest, sometimes games where it doesn't come off for her. And I do think we've seen that on occasion. I also think in big games she tends to show up. The question I have, I guess, is how many players like that can you afford to have on the field? And that may be one thing that keeps Jill Ellis from, say, starting Rapinoe and Tobin Heath together, because I think they're similar players who try stuff that doesn't always come off, and how many players can you have on the field at the same time where there's that risk being run?
Yeah, that's definitely a fair point. I think, look, her service from that side of the field, though, is tremendous. And, you know, she didn't get the assist on the go-ahead goal for the U.S. that went to Sydney Leroux, but her takedown, control of the ball, and then lob to find Leroux in space before the cutback to Press really sparked that play. You know, in a lot of ways, like Bradley against the Netherlands, he didn't get credit for two of the assists, but he was the architect, and that was kind of Rapinoe against Australia. Now, Brian, I know you think it's a little bit much how we kind of dissect every U.S. women's game. At the end of the day, they won 3-1. They have 3 points in the World Cup and in the tournament's toughest group, and they're set up pretty well. Do you find yourself on the Australian FA side of things, where you think Australia is clearly a better footballing nation? Quote.
Whoever wrote that is the next director of communications for FIFA. There's no question about it. Just the angst and consternation that people had during and after that game. You know, we're at the point with the U.S. women where, you know, a 3-1 win at the World Cup, where in the end, at the conclusion of the 90 minutes, and I've got news for you, the last 30 minutes of a game are just as important as the first 30 minutes of the game. You know, we're at the point where that's so boring that people need to nitpick and find sort of whatever problems they can find. This is not a perfect team by any stretch, but to say that it's slipped dramatically or that it's far worse or far different than its predecessors just doesn't really ring true to me. I mean, this team actually wins more frequently than they used to. If you look at, like, you know, 8 to 10 year long kind of, you know, if you look at generational results over the timeline of the U.S. women's program, the team has never won more frequently than it does now. They've lost 11 of their last 220 games. That is absolutely remarkable. That means basically every loss is a statistical fluke. And a big reason for that, and Grant referenced this on Twitter the other day, over the course of 90 minutes, they may look shaky for 20 or 30, but over the course of 90, this team is almost unbeatable, except against Japan in the World Cup final. But they have a level of fitness and athleticism and commitment and an ability to change games late that other teams simply can't match year after year after year. You know, there are some issues with the balance in midfield that may play a role in games against the three or four teams that are good enough to beat them, France, Germany, you know, maybe Japan, maybe Canada, etc. But this is a team that will win all three games in this group. This is a team that should have no problems at least getting to the semifinals. And once they get that far in this tournament, it's going to require a historic Herculean effort to beat them. And that's what history shows over and over and over with this team. And you guys mentioned Wambach, whether she should be starting or not. Think about what an incredible advantage that is. I mean, not only do you have a team as a whole that's fitter and more composed toward the latter stages of a game, then with 20 minutes to go against a tired opponent, you bring on Wambach, who knows she doesn't need to you know, figure out a way to make it through 90 minutes. She's just got to go hard for 20, 25, and that's going to make a difference. This team, like I said, there are some balance issues. We don't know if they're going to hold up defensively, but they don't have to be perfect. They don't have to beat the 1999 team that also had a couple close calls, if you remember. All they've got to do is beat the other teams in this tournament, and they're well set up to do that. And I don't think there should be that much concern and that much consternation over what were a couple of shaky minutes in the opening game of a World Cup against the top 10 team.
Yeah, that's a fair point. And I think a couple of things. First, the standard level that's been set for this team is just abnormally high, right?
Impossibly high. Impossibly high.
Right. So everything that doesn't go right for them, we are going to skewer a little bit. That's what we do. That's what fans do. That's what media does. That's what social media era does, right? I think that plays into it as well. You start the snowball effect of dissenters and some people who, you know, start picking apart everything, and it gets a little out of hand. Now, that's not to say that they're wrong, and like you said, they didn't play a perfect game.
No, they're not wrong, and if they enjoy doing it, then that's great. But, you know, more power to them. But this is, like I said, this is a team that every loss that they have is historic. I mean, it's literally historic when they lose a game. And so that they may not win the World Cup. I mean, Jordan's Bulls won a championship less than half the time. Gretzky's Oilers. I mean, Secretariat lost races, right? I mean, that happens. But, you know, you're going to take the U.S. women in a game 7 out of 10 times against the other top teams in the world. And in this particular World Cup, Germany is not at full strength. France has not proven it can do it in the biggest games at the highest level. You know, who would you pick to win this World Cup other than the U.S. right now? I think they're gonna find their rhythm. I think they're gonna get it together, and I think over time, Jill Ellis is gonna figure out the best way to use Abby Wambach. She's gonna find a combination in midfield, an attacking combination that works. If the center backs figure it out and play to their capability, and Hope Solo makes the two or three saves that she can make, they're going to be fine.
Yeah, and I think that's the hope on their end. I will say that.
But bum.
Yeah, I didn't even mean that. That's terrible.
It's funny the Australian screed said something about you know, if not for the goalkeeper, right? Didn't it make some kind of reference like that? If not for the players on their team, they wouldn't be as good. What does that even mean? You know, if not for Tom Brady, Avi, you wouldn't have, you know, the Patriots wouldn't have won the Super Bowl.
That's factually correct.
Well, the Patriots.
That is factually correct. Man, I want to read the Australian recap of every game now, though. That was a massive PR play, because now I'm going after they play Nigeria. If Nigeria wins 4-0, I can't wait to read about the greatness that is the Australian national team. I will say this, the women's field internationally has gotten better. Nigeria if you watch them against Sweden, they can attack. They looked very, very dangerous. The U.S. isn't out of the woods by any stretch just because they've won this one game and because they have all of this history. But you are right that statistically over time, it is shocking when they lose.
The rest of the world is to say countries like Nigeria are getting better, it, to me, is different than saying that teams are catching up. I realize that if you're getting better, then sort of by definition, you are moving closer. But I don't see that happening. I don't see there are the same number of legitimate threats to the U.S. and title threats in this tournament as there was in 1999. You know, there's two or three other teams that can win it, just like there was in 1999. I mean, it's wonderful for women's soccer, certainly, that we see teams like Nigeria getting, you know, Spain playing the other day, getting their first chance at a Women's World Cup. I think the expansion of the tournament is great. I think the fact that more countries are taking it seriously is great. I think countries in a new transparent FIFA should be incentivized and monitored to invest in women's soccer, to spend some of this windfall on women's soccer. I think all of that's great. But at the very, very top end, you still have maybe three or four countries that can win the thing. And so in that sense, I don't think the U.S. is being caught. I think that there are still only a couple of teams that can beat them on a given day. And those are the teams that they have to worry about at this tournament. And you know, go back to 99, replace China with Japan and replace Norway with France, and you basically have the same number of teams that could win it. It hasn't changed that much.
That's an interesting and fair viewpoint. And to that end too, the U.S. has never not made the semifinals, right? I mean, it's what they do. That's why the expectations are there. They've won it the same amount of times as Germany. So, you know, obviously Germany is one of the top competitors in this field. And after a 10-0 win, granted the opposition, but still, 10-0 is 10-0 in a World Cup, no less.
Well, there's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong with criticizing the team, certainly, and there's nothing wrong with holding them to a higher standard. But we have to remember that they're not necessarily playing differently than they did 15 years ago. I mean, the U.S. has always played, you know, a very direct. I mean, Mia Hamm would touch the ball past players and run past them. You know, Michelle Akers would run through them. You know, things aesthetically haven't really changed that much since what we consider to be the golden days of the U.S. women's national team, when, again, I'll add, they didn't win as often as they do now.
Look, you're right in a lot of ways. I think that we're in for two competitive group games still. Sweden on Friday, and then the following Tuesday against Nigeria. The U.S. gets through that. Then they go to the knockout stage. As Grant has pointed out, both in the magazine and on last week's podcast, it really is imperative that the U.S. wins their group and doesn't finish second. If they win the group, it sets up a much easier path to the semifinals. If they do not, then they're looking at some of the top competitors, potentially Brazil, Japan, in the earlier knockout rounds.
Although they would avoid a semifinal against either France or Germany, right? If they
True, but you're expecting that high level game in the semifinals.
In the semifinal, yeah.
You'd rather it then than in the round of 16. So, look, we'll see what happens. But 3 points are in the bag. We would expect more on the way, but you never know. There's
been a lot of empty seats on these games I'm watching on TV.
Yeah, which is unfortunate because the action has been great. There have been some tremendous goals. France, Mexico, Colombia, off the top of my head, Netherlands, in their first game ever, their first World Cup goal was just brilliant—a rocket from Lico Martens.
To be fair, I literally have no clue what they're charging for these tickets. I mean, I don't know if I'd spend $100 to go to a Women's World Cup game. I have no idea what they're charging.
Maybe not. But at the end of the day, there's been some good action on the field. Action picks back up, and we will see where it goes from here. And to that end, I think we're going to call it a day for us. So for Grant Wall, Brian Strauss, I am Avi Krediter. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time.
Do you about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.